Welcome to Parents' Perspective. Carrie, get moving, Mark hollered to his 15-year-old daughter. You can't be late for practice. Dad, chill. Carrie came thumping down the stairs, her gym bag dragging behind her. What do you mean, chill? He fumed. How can you expect to impress the coach if you can't even get to practice on time? As a matter of fact, it's the ones who are there early who really get noticed. Dad, it's only the basketball team, for heaven's sake. Carrie grabbed her jacket and slouched out the front door. Get a grip. Young lady, Mark slammed the door behind them. How many times do I have to tell you that? Yeah. Carrie pulled open the car door wearily. Better than average isn't our best, she recited. But couldn't you get off my case for once? Maybe I am really average. Have you ever thought of that? From a parent's perspective, how can we keep ourselves from the trap of overbearing expectations as parents? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest has written two books to help parents with just such issues. Dr. Brad Sachs is a family psychologist and the author of The Good Enough Child, How to Have an Imperfect Family and Be Perfectly Satisfied, and The Good Enough Teen, Raising Adolescents with Love and Acceptance, Despite How Impossible They Can Be. He's also the founder and director of the Father Center and an active speaker, giving workshops and talks around the country to parents and mental health professionals. Dr. Sachs himself is the father of three teenage children. Welcome to Parents' Perspective.
Thank you very much for having me.
Dr. Sachs, why are we so wedded to the myth of the perfect family if no one, in fact, actually has one?
Parenthood is a very daunting, anxiety-provoking, and worrisome endeavor, and we all have fears about how our children are going to turn out, how we're doing, and how they're doing. So as long as we have this ideal or this myth of a perfect family in mind, we imagine that we can take over and vanquish those worries and those fears. In reality, of course, trying to be perfect makes family life much harder than it needs to be because nobody's capable of being perfect. But we hold on to that image so tightly because we imagine it'll gently take away all of those fears and worries that are a part of the parenting package.
It's funny. I remember different stages of my kids having different issues. And when I got something that worked for something, I thought, oh, good, now we're all set. And, of course, 2 days later,
yes,
it didn't work anymore.
But there's tremendous relief in those moments, and you want to assume that every problem is solvable, that every family conflict has a solution, and that's not the case.
Is that very American, every problem is solvable? Do Europeans have this?
I think it's probably human in general, but there's probably a part of it that's specifically endemic to Americans. We have that can-do attitude, and everything should be tackled with energy and verve and initiative and conscientiousness. So we might bring some of that maladaptively to parenthood and expect that parenthood's going to work the same way as everything else works, and it doesn't.
What kinds of expectations are we as parents especially susceptible to?
I think every parent brings expectations to parenthood, and you know, from time immemorial, parents have had wishes and dreams and fantasies for their children. What I try to do is help parents distinguish between the expectations that are relevant and appropriate for their children and ones that are less so or that might even get in the way. We want to have expectations that are high enough that we challenge our children, we motivate them and mobilize them and convey our faith in them, but we don't want those expectations so high that they constantly feel like they're disappointing or disillusioning us, or that we feel like we're being disappointed and disillusioned. So I try to help parents look at the origin of their expectations. Sometimes those are conscious ones. We might expect our children to do things that we didn't do, or we might expect our children to do things that we did do. And sometimes they're less conscious and a little bit more on the periphery of our awareness. Sometimes we might expect our children to be good enough that our parents give us the blessing that we never got when we were younger. Sometimes we expect our children to improve our marriage or to make up for someone dear to us who has departed. So when parents can pay attention to the constellation of conscious and unconscious expectations, they're generally able to select on their own which ones are relevant and which ones might not be appropriate for this or that child at a particular stage in development.
I think what you just said about appropriate for this and that child is a real key here, too.
Right.
We can't expect or plan for the same things at all in each child.
Every child's different. We're different as parents with each child and at every stage of their development and our development. And so there isn't any one size fits all. And while we might rejoice and celebrate when a particular intervention or strategy works with one child at one particular point in development, it's not going to work with every child, and it may not even work with that child at the next stage of development. So we constantly have to keep our knees flexed and be able to adapt to their growing and changing needs.
How do we do that without having a crisis or something negative happen in between?
Well, crises are not really avoidable in families. That's one of the things that we have to come to terms with. There's going to be bumps in the road and tremendous obstacles, and that's part of what brings us together as families. We come together as human beings through our failures and our weaknesses much more than through our successes and triumphs. And so every family, when they have these periods of disillusionment or crisis or disappointment, if they can stay connected and cohesive through it, find that they grow warmer and closer and more trusting of each other. And that's really one of the goals and objectives of family life, which is to create that. So I don't think that it's always preventable. And in fact, one of the things that helps parents is remembering that much of what's difficult is supposed to be difficult. And if we can kind of accept that and learn to tolerate it and live with it, everyone tends to do better.
What would you say are some of the characteristics of the good enough child that we can calm ourselves down about?
Well, as I was saying a moment ago, we have this image of child development as this sort of flawless linear trajectory, one step after another, constantly moving up to some promontory of health and development. That's really not how child development unfolds. It's really not how adult development unfolds. So it's not one step after another. It's one step up and two steps back and five steps up and three steps back. And there's long periods during child development when they're not going to be doing what we want them to do, but that doesn't mean they're not doing what they need to be doing. So there will be periods of underachievement or stagnation or opposition or rebelliousness or defiance. And those are essential parts of developing a sense of identity, a sense of separateness, and ultimately autonomy. And when we see those stages and those phases as necessary and crucial to the development of their healthy identity, then we're better able to navigate them and abide them.
One of your caveats in the book is beware of advice. How can we navigate the difficult terrain of parenting without some kind of roadmap?
Well, everyone has a difficult time with parenthood, and we all kind of need that compass. But one of the things that's happened in this country in particular, I think, is there's now a enormous sort of titanic parenting industry, which I think serves to discourage parents from trusting their own instincts, from being able to reflect thoughtfully on themselves and their own children. And so when I say beware of advice, it's not that we're not all looking for some guidance and some perspective. But what happens is sometimes we wind up abandoning our own best interests and our children's best interests because of what other people think we ought to be doing. So the belief that if we're not playing Mozart for our fetus or we're not signing them up for dance lessons at the age of two, that somehow we're depriving our children. I think all of that steers us away from some family true north that I think every parent has within them. And it's our job to go inside and find that rather than look outside for that perspective.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on non-judgmental parenting.
Washington, D.C. with Kids, The Popular Fodor's Guide by Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We are talking with Dr. Brad Sachs, author of The Good Enough Child and The Good Enough Teen.
What are the basic hallmarks of a competently functioning family? What should we be satisfied with?
Ultimately, you've done your job if you have raised self-reliant, self-sufficient young adults, and that's really the key. I don't really care what the SAT scores were, or the sixth grade science project was, or what college they got into. Until our children become autonomous and self-reliant and can function on their own, we haven't really finished our job. And so that's really the hallmark of what a functioning family is, which is a family that allows and encourages its children to leave home with both generations feeling decently about how the process went and without any of them sort of being degraded or dehumanized in the process.
Are there any hallmarks along the way that you can say, check that off, it seems to be going well, or check that off?
Well, there's lots of good signs and there's lots of promising indicators, but I've seen a million kids and a million families over the years, and everyone takes a different trajectory. So I would be hard-pressed to say this is the map or the path or the blueprint that guarantees the outcome that you want, because there's always a lot of detours along the way.
I'm thinking of parents are feeling like, well, isn't there something I can feel good about? Isn't there something I did that I can feel like, okay, well, that's a good step along the way?
Well, being able to assess your child's strengths and reinforce and amplify those strengths is crucial, and being able to help them understand and identify their weaknesses and learn how to compensate for those weaknesses, those are kind of crucial building blocks towards having a healthy identity. I mean, everyone's good at some things and not so good at others. When we help our children to build upon or augment what they're naturally good at or inclined to do and learn how to make up for or compensate what comes with difficulty, generally kids wind up with a solid sense of self-respect and are more likely to move towards separation and autonomy in healthy ways.
Can you give an example of something like that that you've seen, reinforcing a child's strength and being able to help him or her compensate for a weakness?
Well, sure. I mean, earlier today, I was seeing a young man who is very, very talented musically, but not much of a scholar. He has tremendous difficulty reading, and he struggles with everything that's academic, and he's in high school now. And, of course, his parents focus on how he's doing academically and are worried about how he's going to do. But the focus has been so much on what he's unable to do naturally that he loses sight of how gifted he is as a musician, and they lose sight of that as well. But as we began to talk about what it would be like for him to pursue music and what he'd have to do academically to get to a place where he could study music, it began to occur to him that there might be value in coming up with some different ways of studying or approaching academics that would work for him. But the key opens on the inside, not on the outside, and the parents insisting that he approach school differently isn't going to make a difference. He has to change for reasons that are meaningful to him. So by building on the strength, which is his innate interest in and desire to be a good musician, and helping him compensate for the weakness, which is academic, and the way you compensate is by encouraging him to think about a career in music and some of the academic skills he'll have to learn to get there, and that gives him a sense that there's a future, and he winds up less demoralized, and the parents wind up less frustrated.
That sounds like a very hopeful future if he is beginning to see the light that, hey, there are other skills I need to enhance my music.
But only if he sees them as ways to get where he wants to go. Now, he may or may not become a musician for a career. He may or may not become a professor, for all we know. But what he's starting to understand is there's reasons to overcome some of the things that are difficult for him. And once he believes there's a reason for that, then there's reason to be hopeful.
In your book, The Good Enough Child, you say, disentangling our kids' accomplishments and failures from ours is one of the hardest but most necessary of parental endeavors. Would you explain and give us some examples? We all think we're fine. We don't have any problems.
One of the great challenges for parents is trying to distinguish what we want from our children from what we want for our children. And many times those two things get blurred together. We have an image that we're like Geppetto and we're carving these children into little Pinocchios who are going to reflect well upon us and make good on our wishes to ourselves and our deferred promises and dreams. But really, children aren't there to validate and reflect well upon us. They're there to become their own person. And so every parent has to find a way to disentangle themselves and their identity and their accomplishments from their children's. One of the things that I try to help parents understand is that the person of the parent is really more important than the person as the parent. We have to figure out a way to be a person without relying solely on being a parent and revolving our lives around children's lives and making their life the axis on which everyone else's revolves. So the more that we can focus on what they need to do and where they're at, the more likely they're going to get to where they need to go. One of the situations I described in The Good Enough Teen was a young man who was 17, and he was getting headaches and stomach aches that no one could figure out the reason for. And his parents were both physicians. His father was a surgeon, and his mother was an obstetrician. And they came in for a consultation because they couldn't figure out what to do about the headaches and the stomach aches. And I asked them, you know, your son's 17, he's starting senior year. What is it that you would envision him doing with his life? And the father said, well, he's 17, he's approaching his departure from home. It's really his life. So whichever branch of medicine he wants to enter is perfectly okay with us.
Oh, my.
And you're laughing, and I was about to laugh, but the parents weren't laughing, and Danny wasn't laughing because that was the bind that he was in. So it was an example of the parents having too carefully laid out and narrowed the path that this young man was feeling like he could consider following, and that plays out indirectly with some of the physical distress that he was feeling. So we all have these expectations and wishes and fantasies, and you can't make them go away. What you can do is become more aware of them and try to gauge with a little more accuracy and precision which ones really are appropriate for this child at this stage and which ones need to be relinquished.
I remember when I was in the hospital with my newborn first son and my dad, who was a diehard Redskins fan from day one and always had tickets and went in the snow and the rain and the hail, arrived at the hospital room to visit me carrying a football helmet and a tiny little football. And I thought, I'm not sure whether he's really expecting this or he's trying to do this for fun. I'm not sure
right.
His first grandchild is someone he wants to see us raise as a football player.
Right.
But we just, you know, we laughed about it, we joke about it. Now my little grandchildren play with that same little football.
Right.
And so far, nobody in our family has grown up to be a pro. My middle son does hold over my head that I wouldn't sign the papers in high school to let him play. Is it helpful to our kids and to us to acknowledge that we're not so perfect? How can we do this effectively?
Well, I think it's essential. One of the things that I tell parents is if you could be perfect, the downside would be that your children would never leave you. They'd be sticking around forever because there'd be no motivation to go anywhere. So we have to constantly be willing to disappoint our children and our teenagers.
Whew, then we're doing a great job.
Yay!
That's exactly the reaction you should have, because that's what prompts young adults to summon the courage and marshal the resources to move ahead with their lives. If everything was absolutely perfect at home, no one would have any motivation or desire to take the risk of change and leave. So, yeah, at every age, we want to help reassure our children that we're not perfect because they are prone to idealizing us, particularly at younger ages, and imagining that we don't have any flaws or foibles of our own. And when we're able to do that in a balanced way, it helps them to feel more comfortable and more accepting of their own flaws and weaknesses and imperfections, which is part of having a meaningful and successful life.
When my oldest son, the one who had received the football helmet and football, was in early nursery school, we went for our first parent conference, and we were very excited. This is a competent little guy, you know, with his strengths and his weaknesses, and we thought the teacher would say nice things. And one of the first things she said to us was, "Do you ever make mistakes?" And we're like, "Oh, no. You know, what have we done now?" She said, "Your son needs to know that you make mistakes, mm-hmm. that you have some things go wrong. Do you ever burn the toast? Did you ever drop and break a dish? You need to say, 'Oh, no, I burned the toast.'" And it never occurred to us. Those kinds of things, yeah, they happen in every family, but it didn't seem important that our son be exposed to that. And she stressed how important it was that he was very uptight about fitting a perfect mold because his parents never made mistakes.
Right.
Of course, he was very little. He learned differently. We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on non-judgmental parenting.
For an audio CD of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $15 with your name, mailing address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015.
Well, Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. We're talking with Dr. Brad Sachs, author of The Good Enough Child and The Good Enough Teen.
You never feel secure and any sense of self-respect if you don't know that you can handle failure and disappointment. That's really the key to a solid identity. And that's why we have to show our children that we have dealt with disappointment and failure and somehow managed and survived. And that's what gives them the sort of model and the inspiration to do the same thing. So parents always try to be very positive and to reinforce and to praise, but that's not really the basis of self-esteem. The basis of self-esteem is knowing that you are going to fail, that you're going to disappoint yourself and others, and understanding that you move on despite having done so. When kids know that they can handle disappointment and failure, that's when they feel secure, and that's when they feel a sense of self-assuredness. Sir, your son's teacher was wise to give you that advice, and you were wise to follow it.
It wasn't hard to follow.
Right.
Well, it's interesting because they say you learn more from your failures than from your successes.
Yes, absolutely. And one thing you learn is that you can survive those failures. And when you know that you can survive failures and still be loved and accepted by yourself and by others, then you can do anything. Then you're willing to take the risk of change or creativity or growth. Otherwise, you tend to stay in place. And life kind of feels like a minefield. You're afraid to take a step in any direction because you're going to wind up getting injured.
Is there a special talk or anything parents could do with teenagers who sometimes end up having a life path where right when they get to be teenagers, then they're trying out for this or they're trying out for that, and they're constantly disappointing themselves?
Yes. Well, adolescence is important because that's when they begin preparing for life, and part of life is encountering failure and disappointment and realizing you're ordinary, not extraordinary. And while we may have worked hard to build our children up or convince them or ourselves that they're extraordinary during the early stages of life, once they reach adolescence, they realize that they're more ordinary than extraordinary. They don't make every team, or they don't get every award, or they don't get into the college they want, or they don't get the test scores that they want. And we have to help them see that they're still valuable and lovable and worthwhile despite not being perfect, despite not being extraordinary, and help them to see that ultimately it's who you are as a person and how you live and how you love that makes for a meaningful life, not what your accomplishments and achievements are.
How do you square that with situations I was thinking about? The very famous physics teacher in Los Angeles, I can't remember what his name is right now, but who took a class of kids who were from a very low socioeconomic group and made them all terrific physics students and so forth and so on. In other words, the idea of high expectations and children rise to meet them and all that.
Well, as I said earlier, you want to have expectations that are high enough that it conveys a sense of faith and trust and belief in a child's capacities. But you don't want them to think that they have failed if they don't meet those expectations. And that's what I see with a lot of the children that I work with and a lot of families. If they can't be perfect or the best, then they feel like they have failed and they're the worst. Or they decide to be perfect failures because they can't be perfect successes. Mm-hmm. So it becomes one extreme or the other. So what happens in a situation like that is that a teacher is able to convey to these students that they have gifts and talents and strengths that they're not aware of. But that's different than expecting things that children are not capable of. For most kids, if they can do it, they do do it. And we have to help them figure out what they can do and let go of what they can't. But if they could, they would.
And that means giving them an environment that allows them to see what other gifts they might have.
Sure. And not rotating the entire axis of their identity on what we think is most important, whether it's being social or being popular or being scholarly or being athletic or being musical. That's where we have to distinguish what we want for them from what we want from them. We can't expect them to be who we want them to be, and we can't presume to know what's best for them. Some things are obvious. We know it's good not to get involved with drugs. But aside from those basic things that pretty much everyone can agree to, we don't really know what's best. And I work with tremendously successful and talented adults who have empty lives because they never developed that sense of what was enough or good enoughness or a sense of what really gives life purpose and meaning, because it's not money and it's not accomplishments and it's not achievements.
And it's not things.
Right, and it's not things. So as long as you rely on those, you always feel insecure because they can always evaporate.
It's interesting, as I'm listening to you, it's almost a plug for community service being an important part of a child's growing up.
Yes,
because it's a balance to...
Oh, I think, unfortunately, we have to work very hard to create opportunities for that because it doesn't happen naturally. You know, when parents will call me if they're moving to the area from outside, and they'll say, you know, which of the high schools have the highest average SAT scores, or which of the high schools have the highest acceptance rates, I ask them to think about, well, which high schools have the highest rate of community service, or to what extent is the school that you're looking at have the most connectedness between students and faculty. That's what's missing, and we have to make that more of a priority, because that's what leads to a meaningful and purposeful life. Not acquiring or achieving or accomplishing. Those are time limited. You don't take those with you.
Well, speaking of time limited, we are looking at the clock, and I think, unfortunately, our time is limited, but we really have had a wonderful conversation, and Dr. Brad Sachs, thank you so much for helping us understand what it is to have an imperfect family and to make it work.
Thank you very much for inviting me here.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of Dr. Sachs' book, The Good Enough Child, How to Have an Imperfect Family and Be Perfectly Satisfied, or The Good Enough Teen, Raising Adolescents with Love and Acceptance, Despite How Impossible They Can Be. This is truly an experienced father. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address, and mention show number 315. Do spell anything that's not obvious. Again, that's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. Please tell us, if you can, what station you're listening to. Since we're airing all over the world, it's always fun to know where you're tuning in.
Visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org. That's www.parentsperspective.org, where you can even listen to a show of your choice. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Today's program was made possible with generous support from the SF Foundation. Our sound engineer is Drew Chapp. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.